This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
In Belgium, a migrant hunger strike gets international attention. An agreement is reached with the strikers, but the government is drawing a line.
You cannot just believe that by being here for a few years, you have the automatic permission of staying here.
Also today, Syria tries to return to peace, but a boom in the use of recreational drugs puts that in check.
For those left in Syria, drugs are really threatening to destroy what little remains of a society after more than a decade of civil war.
I'm Marco Werman, and for Olympic athletes, the pandemic turned things upside down, especially the ones who got COVID, like Hungarian fencer Ida Mohamed.
Barely doing anything, I could feel my heartbeat nonstop.
But she recovered, trained, and is ready to compete in her 7th Olympics. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Thursday. Another sign that things are getting back to normal. Pretty soon, fans of the Toronto Blue Jays can at long last hear this in Toronto.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land.
After nearly 2 years of playing home games in Buffalo, the Blue Jays are returning home. It's part of the Canadian government's plan to reopen to some American travelers, at least. But for Canadians heading south, they'll need to wait a bit longer. The U.S. now says it will keep its land borders closed to many travelers, both from Canada and Mexico. Tony Payan teaches at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston. Tony, let's talk first about the Toronto Blue Jays. Canada's granted the team an exemption so they can resume play in Toronto on July 30th. That'll be the first time since 2019. Are there any restrictions linked to that exemption?
Not really. I think Canada is a country that's behaved quite well. I think about 71% of all Canadians have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and about 52-53% are fully vaccinated. So it's well ahead, I think, of other countries. And this is symbolic. This is a way to signal to the world that Canada is open with certain restrictions and precautions. And this is a way to signal to the Canadians that things are coming back to normal.
And will all players and anyone associated with the team have to show they've been vaccinated before entering Canada?
That seems to be the requirement. The Canadian government is going to allow anyone to cross the border by land if they show that they've been vaccinated.
Canada also just announced it's opening its borders back up to fully vaccinated Americans or non-essential travelers. Which Americans?
That will be any American resident or citizen of the United States that can show proof of vaccination. That's something really significant. Those of us who are more focused on the U.S.-Mexico border have been actually advocating for that. There is no reason to restrict anyone, really, who can legally cross the border that can show that he or she has been vaccinated. Restricting them from crossing the border, I think it's really not justified any longer. So Canada is definitely signaling they're ready for an open border with those measures in place.
And today, where are we at? Who is allowed to enter in and out of Mexico from the U.S.?
Nothing has changed throughout the pandemic and today. Any American or any U.S. permanent resident can go into Mexico travel freely around the country with no restrictions, no questions asked, no tests, and of course, no proof of vaccination. That's still going on. In the case of Mexico, it's really a tragic case that Mexico was not able to discern carefully and put in place a system to check anybody that was coming in and ensure minimally that they were not infected, unlike Canada, which was quite the contrast.
So the Biden administration has not reciprocated. In fact, it's extended non-essential travel restrictions for its borders with Canada and Mexico until the 21st of August. Why is that? And what does that just mean practically?
It really is incomprehensible to me that the Biden administration is not reciprocating. I recently wrote about this issue, and I think that it is very reasonable to allow those who show proof of vaccination to cross land borders, both in Canada and in Mexico, of course. There is no reason to stop people from using the border crossers from going back and forth to conduct their family, social, and of course, economic activities.
So we've been talking about non-essential travel, Tony. What about other people like asylum seekers and migrants?
That's a very good question. Obviously, asylum seekers, what they do is they show up at the international bridges in Texas, at the ports of entry in Arizona or in California, and they turn themselves to U.S. authorities. They are brought in. They are processed in the United States. They're given tests. The facilities are often crowded. There was a big problem with infections in detention facilities in the United States, and then they were often expelled back into Mexico. The change, of course, between Trump and Biden was that minors were no longer deported into Mexico, and they were kept in the United States and given a test and ensured that they were negative, but they were ultimately processed. That was a very different case, though, because many of these asylum seekers at the end of the day were allowed into the United States, and then the authorities, the bureaucrats at the border were scrambling to figure out what to do with them and how to prevent higher infection rates. But that was exceptional. Any other Mexican citizen or resident with a visa, resident of the border, was not allowed to cross. But if you were an asylum seeker, you had to be processed.
Tony Payan is the director of the Center for United States and Mexico at Rice University in Houston. Tony, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
In Thailand, there's a big development for women struggling with unwanted pregnancies. Abortion had been mostly illegal in the country, but as of this year, Thai women can get an abortion during the first trimester for any reason. Still, pro-choice advocates say that despite this progress, women seeking abortion still face resistance, and it's not because of the legal system. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Someone in Thailand goes to get an abortion, and the doctor says, I could help you legally, but I won't. Supicha Bautip is a pro-choice advocate in Bangkok, and she says this sort of thing is happening a lot.
Many women tell us that they are rejected from the clinic.
For 10 years, Supicha has run a hotline for people seeking advice on how to get an abortion in Thailand. Before the law changed back in February, she'd steer people towards gynecologists who might bend the law to help them out, or tell them about pills they could take at home. Now she hears from women who are trying to do it the legal way, but still face an obstacle.
The attitude of the doctor, nurse, themselves.
Their attitude is often, we feel this procedure is morally wrong.
It's more than the feeling, it's the belief. This is a spiritual thing.
Thailand is 95% Buddhist. Karma, the concept that a cosmic force can punish you for immoral deeds in this life or the next, that is very entrenched. And so is the idea that abortion is bad karma. Supicha knows one female doctor who is sympathetic to women who need abortions, but she won't do the procedure until she's had her own child. Because what if she's rendered infertile by karma?
And that is more than science. It's more about the spiritual stuff.
Under the old law, Thai women could face 3 years in prison just for getting an abortion. That changed because judges, mostly conservative men in dark robes, decided that was wrong. It's seen as a big step forward in Southeast Asia, where in most countries, abortion is mostly illegal. But Supicha says Thai women are now held back by a different group of conservative men who wear orange robes, Buddhist monks. After this new ruling on abortion, one highly revered monk, Prat Ratchathamani Thet, told Thai reporters, abortion is still a sin, committed by women who are, quote, spoiled. The monk said, these women are ready to indulge their desire, which creates the baby, but aren't ready to raise the baby. I asked Supicha Bautip, the pro-choice advocate, if this is pretty mainstream thinking from most Thai monks.
Yes, of course, because they're men. He would never get the unplanned pregnancy himself. So he can say anything.
Buddhist monks have huge influence on Thai society. The medical profession is no exception. Buddhist scripture is not very explicit about abortion, but Buddhist monks interpret the Buddha's teachings a certain way, and people take it to heart. Supichai is constantly hearing from women who need to get an abortion, but still want to heed the advice of religious authorities.
It makes them feel confused, because I should believe the monk. But what they say really against my life and really hurt me, and I still have to listen.
Thailand also has a very high teen pregnancy rate, something the government is worried about, and this liberalized abortion law is partly aimed at that issue. But real progress, Supichai says, would require a shift in attitude inside the monkhood. Only that's an institution almost no one wants to challenge.
Even if the law changed, but the attitude doesn't change, nothing is going to happen.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
For roughly $25 a pop, the drug Captagon can be bought on the streets throughout the Persian Gulf region. Captagon is a party drug containing amphetamines. Those who use it claim that with one pill, they can dance all weekend. In Syria, its popularity has been massive.
Syria is now the world's largest pusher of Captagon, and it's got to the point where even pharmaceutical plants, which used to be quite important for Syria, even they have now been converted into pill factories just to keep the supply going.
That's Nicholas Pelham, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. He spoke with Jason Palmer, the host of The Intelligence from The Economist podcast. Jason, why and how did this drug get so big? What did Nicholas Pelham discover?
Well, it really took off after the start of Syria's civil war, which is now a little more than 10 years ago. Initially, it was used by commanders who just wanted to give their troops a stimulant. It had this nickname of chemical courage. But then there was this influx of fighters from other parts of the drug-producing world who saw an opportunity. Syria's formal economy was collapsing as this grinding war continued, as international sanctions started to really bite. These are big incentives for drug production, for illicit production of all sorts, and this fragmented war zone provided ideal cover for smuggling.
Is this happening openly in Syria? Like, are Syrian officials turning a blind eye?
Well, it depends on who you ask. The official line on this is that the government says it's not involved. Nicholas spoke to one economist who's loyal to the government, who, as you might expect, dismissed the idea as just propaganda. But as Nicholas told us, the word on the streets suggests different.
It's really not difficult to speak to smugglers themselves now in Syria. And, you know, there's just a general recognition that the formal economy has collapsed and the assets are now dependent to keep the regime functioning on an informal economy and particularly on the Captagon trade. And this is just a way in which warlords are paying their troops, and that's how kind of loyalists in the regime remain loyal. And, you know, it's got to the extent where even the president's own family are part and parcel of the trade. Some of his relatives are running operations out of the Mediterranean ports of Latakia and Tartus, which are kind of key for getting Captagon out of Syria. So, yeah, this is really what is keeping the assets afloat.
What I'm hearing there, Jason, is that Captagon is being smuggled into regions around the globe. How widespread is Captagon trafficking?
Well, it's hard to know how much there is and how far it's getting, but drug busts are a good proxy. Foreign seizures alone last year had a street value of almost $3.5 billion. And you see these enormous hauls. Last year in Italy, police seized 84 million pills. Then in May, there was an even bigger bust in Malaysia, 94 million pills. But inevitably, not every pill makes it out of Syria. And I asked Nicholas whether the country has its own Captagon problem, and he told me this.
So there was one survey in January that found that a third of Syrians in the north now knew a drug user. That's up from just 7% 2 years ago. I'm speaking to a social worker in Soweida. That's a city which is close to the border with Jordan. It was kind of traditionally a kind of fairly conservative place. It was a kind of Druze stronghold where you had tribal elders sort of really controlling habits and customs in the area. And that kind of old order is just broken down by the extent of the availability of drugs in the city as they pass through the country on their way to Jordan. And perhaps most worrying, war profiteers and warlords are now becoming narco lords and perpetuating Syria's agony. So for those left in Syria, drugs are really threatening to destroy what little remains of a society after more than a decade of civil war.
The Economist's Middle East correspondent Nicholas Pelham in conversation with Jason Palmer. Jason, thanks so much for bringing us this story on Syria's rise in trafficking of the drug Captagon. Sounds troubling.
Marco, thanks very much.
Jason Palmer of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. Remember the debates over huge spending plans for pandemic recovery? The nations that said, this is a chance to build a greener future for the economy. We gauge those efforts just ahead on the show. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Last spring, as the world was still in the grips of the first wave of COVID, a now familiar refrain emerged among world leaders.
Recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic is a chance to set the world on a cleaner, greener, more sustainable path.
This is a huge opportunity to do transformational changes.
We can build back better by building back greener.
Today on The Big Fix, we look at whether building back greener is happening.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
So is recovery funding moving the planet away from fossil fuels? Here's the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
$1 trillion every year for the next 3 years. That's how much it would cost to build back better, according to the International Energy Agency. That would pay for things like solar panels, electric vehicle charging stations, and more energy-efficient buildings. This week, the agency released an analysis of how 50 countries are doing so far.
It's a bit of good news and a bit of bad news.
That's Daniel Wetzel, an energy analyst with the International Energy Agency.
Right now, the good news is that the investments mobilized by government spending today, we estimate to boost clean energy investment by about 30%.
And the bad news?
That needs to be three times that level in order to hit this $1 trillion target.
A separate analysis by the Energy Policy Tracker finds that the world's 20 richest countries have spent more public money on fossil fuels than on renewable energy in the past year and a half.
I think that countries are squandering this opportunity for green recovery.
Joel Jager with the World Resources Institute has been following recovery money since the early days of the pandemic. He points out that back then, countries were throwing money at whatever could help stop the economic freefall and help people survive. Now, some countries can be more strategic.
The big question is, are governments going to supplement that clean energy stimulus in the next 3 years with enough other clean energy investments to get us on track for the goals of the Paris Agreement?
That's a question in the U.S. Jager says as much as $1 trillion of climate spending proposed in President Biden's American Jobs Plan has been stripped out of the bipartisan infrastructure legislation being debated in Washington. Much of it will be back on the table as part of the Democrats' budget resolution this fall. Globally, most of the green recovery spending is happening in richer nations. Malango Mwowo is the managing director of Zeni Zeni Sustainable Finance in South Africa.
Some countries are still addressing the pandemic now, currently, so that recovery process hasn't even begun. They're fighting fires, essentially, with the pandemic at the moment.
To make a green recovery possible, Mwowo says developing countries first need vaccines. Then they need to be able to borrow money and get already promised funds from richer countries to invest in building back better.
Because without it, it just seems very bleak. I don't know, I feel very bleak. If we don't take this opportunity now, I think, to show solidarity from an international finance perspective, I think it would be really a sad indictment on humanity.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry is also calling for solidarity. At a speech in London this week, he argued the globe should pull together now, just like it did after World War II.
And that is precisely what we must do now. Treat climate crisis as the crisis it has become, and mount a response that is comparable to wartime mobilization, a massive opportunity to rebuild our economies after COVID-19, to build better. How many times have you heard that phrase after this pandemic?
Kerry said scaling up the development of clean energy technology is the biggest step for this decade. And he urged countries to come to the table with more ambitious plans at the next UN climate summit in Glasgow this November.
We can, in a little more than 100 days, save the next 100 years.
As it is, after more than a year of calls to build back better, the world is still projected to hit record-high carbon dioxide emissions by 2023. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
For 60 days now, more than 400 undocumented migrants have been on a hunger strike in Belgium. Just in the past few days, several of the strikers stopped drinking any liquids. They've been calling on the Belgian government to grant them the legal right to stay and work there. This week, it looked like the crisis might lead to a government collapse. But last night, a deal was struck. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, is on the line with me now. Just remind us how all this started and why.
Yeah, it actually began over 6 months ago in January when a few hundred undocumented migrants occupied the Beguinage Church. This is this famous 17th century church in the centre of Brussels. They were looking for the government to grant them legal papers, as you said, to work and study there. Some of them had been living in Belgium for up to 20 years, and then it escalated 2 months ago when hundreds of them started refusing food.
And what's been the Belgian government's response?
The government has been pretty steadfast in its refusal to concede to the migrants' demands, in particular Sami Madi. He's the asylum and migration secretary in Belgium, who, by the way, is himself the son of an Iraqi refugee. But his line was for the last 6 months, you know, I feel sorry for their situation. I know it's difficult, but there's no way, as he put it, that he would be blackmailed into legalising their status because of the protest.
Then this week, Orla, the situation really seemed to escalate. There were reports the government was on the verge of falling apart. What happened?
Yeah, so last Friday, some of the migrants said they would take nothing, essentially. No food, no water. A number of the men sewed their lips shut. Some of them were also refusing medical help. There were ambulances coming in and out of the church every day. I spoke yesterday afternoon to one of the migrants, Nada. She's originally from Morocco and she came to Belgium in 2015 with her mum. She's just 20 years old and she had been on a hunger strike for the last month and she stopped drinking water, she told me a few days ago. But all around her, people were becoming increasingly ill. And she made the point, you know, not just physically, but also mentally.
Sometimes they start screaming during the night. They are screaming all of the time, like they are mentally so down. And physically, they cannot walk, they cannot talk. There is too many people who go to the hospital every day. Like 10 people go to the hospital every day.
The charities themselves who were working with the migrants said they thought within a couple of days somebody would die. So then on Monday of this week, two of the parties which make up the Belgian coalition government reported that they were going to pull out of government if one of the migrants died. And this, more than anything, seemed to pressurise the migration minister to try and come up with a solution.
Right. So what was agreed to last night? What was the solution?
Well, this is where it gets a little bit muddy, actually, Marco, because yesterday evening, one of those working with the migrants in the church rang me and said the hunger strike has been suspended. And they said they had reached an agreement with the minister, but they didn't exactly lay out what the agreement was. Sami Madi himself this morning, the migration secretary, he was on Belgian radio this morning saying the government had agreed to look at each of the individuals' cases and a judgment would be made on whether they would be granted legal status. So I was talking to Karen Nessens earlier. She's with the group House of Compassion that works in Beguinage Church. She's been there right from the beginning. But I asked her if there's now a risk that other undocumented migrants in Belgium might think that going on a hunger strike could be the solution they're looking for.
Yeah, that is a real risk indeed. And that's why we need a law that will resolve the situation also for other people. The hunger strike put the issue back on the agenda. So many parties now remember that this is a very important issue to solve.
And Karen Nessens also said to me, you know, for now, there's actually nothing to stop something like this happening all over again.
Our Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, on the end of a hunger strike staged by undocumented migrants who were seeking legalization in Belgium. Orla, thanks very much for the update.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. Forget chocolate and vanilla. China is having a gourmet ice cream moment. Innovative flavors like passion fruit beer and scallion noodle.
First taste, not weird. Second taste, not too bad. And the third time they try it, it's magical.
Those weirdly magical flavors have led to long lines across China. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH. Nord Stream 2, it's a series of massive offshore pipelines that have been in the works since 2011. The goal is to move natural gas directly from Russia to Germany. For years, the U.S., Ukraine, and other European countries have been against the project. Now the U.S. has changed its tune. Following a new deal with Germany, the U.S. has dropped its opposition to the pipelines. Yuval Weber is an assistant professor at Texas A&M's Bush School of Government. He's been following this story closely. Yuval, let's start with the basics. Why is Nord Stream 2 so significant for Germany and for Russia?
So for Germany and Russia, it gives them a direct pipeline of natural gas that cuts out Ukraine. Currently, Russia gets its natural gas to Europe through a number of different pipelines. Some already go through the North Sea, some go through Ukraine, and some go point south. And so what this would do would cut out the necessity of relying on Ukraine as a transit partner between the two big countries.
And Russia doesn't want the pipeline going through Ukraine. Why not?
Well, they've been at war for the last 7 years. So anything that Russia can do to cut out Ukraine, both in terms of having to pay transit fees, as well as making sure that it doesn't have to work with Ukraine in any substantive manner, that's going to be one of the net benefits for Russia and for Putin.
So take us back to the beginning of this project. What has been the U.S. position regarding Nord Stream 2?
So the U.S. position on Russian natural gas into Europe has been in opposition since the 1960s. Also in the past roughly 10, 20 years or so, the United States has also become a really big energy exporter of its own. So that's been part of U.S. interests in opposing Nord Stream 2, both in terms of reducing Russian influence and increasing competition to Russian gas on an economic level.
So that brings us up to this week. Why did the U.S. do this 180 on a pipeline that it opposed for so long?
Well, President Biden came in, the thing was already more than 90% done. And it would appear that he just took a look at the lay of the land and said, it's only a matter of time before this thing really gets done. And obviously, there's a lot of opposition in Washington right now, because the sentiment around town is that anything that allows Russia to increase its geopolitical or economic influence in Europe is ultimately going to weaken NATO resolve and really put Ukraine in a difficult position as it defends its territory and its sovereignty. But then President Biden really sort of took, I think, a look at all the issues that are surrounding his diplomatic approach to Germany and to Europe and said, in effect, that's more important than this particular pipeline. So what can we as the United States do in order to basically compensate Ukraine through this, that, and the other, and basically just move this off the agenda?
I mean, those circumstances are real for sure, but it's hard not to read between the lines and wonder if the U.S. is basically saying it values its relationship with Germany and stability with Russia more than its relationship with Ukraine.
I think the hard-hearted or clear-eyed, as it were, view is the United States views Ukraine as a valuable partner, but Germany is a valuable ally. And that's the fundamental difference.
How are Ukrainian officials reacting to this move by the U.S. on Nord Stream 2?
I think about somewhere between apoplectic and trying to be polite in public. They understand that they need U.S. support more than anything else in order to survive politically. So they can certainly criticize the idea that Europe and the United States are not helping them defend themselves against Russia, but they're obviously not very happy about this.
Yuval, this seems to mark the end of a multi-year saga, Russia and Germany getting what they want and everyone moves on. But what points of geopolitical tension can you see unraveling over the coming years that could impact Nord Stream 2?
So one of the things that Russia's always tried to put itself forward is they want, obviously, Ukraine to collapse. Their view on Ukraine is that Ukraine belongs in their sphere of influence. Ukraine is a buffer zone to protect them against Europe, NATO, the West in general. And what we're talking about is whether Ukraine is going to be able to exercise its own sovereignty and make its own decisions. So there's going to be a lot of different points of conflict in terms of whether Russia will ever increase the level of violence in Ukraine in order to destabilize that country as it gets closer and closer to EU membership. And what Russia is going to take heart from this is when it comes down to the dollars and cents, or, you know, the euros and cents, as it were, the United States and Europe fundamentally don't look at Ukraine as being important enough to jeopardize economic growth. And that's basically what it all came down to.
Yuval Weber is an assistant professor at Texas A&M Bush School of Government's Washington, D.C. campus, speaking with us about the U.S. position on the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline, moving fuel from Germany to Russia, but detouring around Ukraine. As of this week, the U.S. supports the pipeline. Yuval, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's hard to find anyone in the world who doesn't love ice cream, but some places seem to love it more than others. New Zealand and the U.S. at the top of the list. Near the bottom, but zooming up real fast, is China. It now represents the biggest ice cream market in the world. This summer, tourist spots across China are featuring specialty destination popsicles. Yep, Beijing has a Great Wall of China popsicle. In Xi'an, you can find popsicles shaped like the famous terracotta warriors. The world's Rebecca Canther got the assignment, find the best ice cream in Shanghai.
This week, the temperatures have been in the high 90s, a perfect time to do research on China's hottest, or shall I say coolest, new trend. Ice cream that everyone wants to post online. So I gather a research team, my two kids, and head out. First stop, our local 24-hour convenience store, where they mostly sell popsicles.
So you've got your chocolates and vanillas, of course, but you've also got milk flavor, red adzuki bean, and green mung bean flavored popsicles. Most Chinese people grew up with those flavors, and they're still popular.
But new flavors are gaining ground. There's boba tea flavored ice pops with frozen tapioca pearls, and a newer addition, the white rabbit. It tastes like a beloved Chinese candy that everyone eats when they're kids. After this scouting mission, my kids and I search out some more sophisticated offerings. In China, Shanghai is the place for trendy ice cream. There are at least 4 gelato shops within 5 minutes of my office, and it seems like each shop tries to outdo the rest. Bonus Gelato was one of the first in town to explore flavors more familiar to Chinese customers. People wait in long lines for ice cream with names like salted egg yolk, Chinese pecan, and yellow rice wine. This summer, it's serving up full-bodied flavors, like blue cheese with cashews. It's not their most popular offering, but it's extremely rich and flavorful. The owner is Liu Xiaoxun. Like many young Chinese, he's traveled the world. He says his gelato is gaining fans among Chinese who can't stomach Western styles. He says, whatever can make you fat, that's what Americans want in their ice cream. Chinese people want a less sweeter flavor. I make my gelato maybe 30% less sweet than American or European style, he says. On the wall, placards describe each flavor's taste profile, like a fine wine.
Sour, sweet, sick, aroma, and bitter.
He says, this one, the jasmine tea flavor, is aromatic and light, with very little sour or bitter notes and only slightly sweet. Next stop, Gelato Dal Cuore, opened by a Chinese and Singaporean couple. The most popular flavor is simply called Earth. Nearly everyone in the shop is taking photos of themselves eating it. It's vegan, made with oat milk, and it has blue and green swirls, so it really does look like Earth. My kids are very tempted.
So tell me what you want.
I want the salted caramel.
And what do you want?
I don't know which one to choose. I don't know. I want the earth one and the caramel one.
Okay.
And I don't want to have a bellyache.
There are 16 flavors in the display case, and they change daily. Today we can sample a pistachio and watermelon, but also passion fruit beer, black sesame, and pineapple with Sichuan peppercorn. Co-owner Gerard Lowe is in charge of developing the flavors. He trained in the U.S., at Penn State, where the founders of Ben & Jerry's got their start, and also in Italy, where gelato originated. But he says the future of ice cream is here, in China.
Because we come up with all these crazy flavors, and yet it's still very well received. They're always looking out for new things. New things especially that they can post on social media.
That's what Cici Cao is here for. She's spending the summer traveling around China before heading back to the U.S. for grad school. Her favorite flavor?
I think the earth got the win because it looks good and also it tastes not bad. Like, you know, you're eating our earth and so it doesn't minus any points from it.
A few tables down, Qianfeng is here with two friends. They decided he's the adventurous one, so they got him to order the Shanghai Scallion Noodle Gelato. He says, it's a little strange, but it's pretty good. It's just very different from traditional ice cream. Saul says she also tried the scallion noodle flavor.
So we tried that and it wasn't so good.
I didn't like it.
I mean, ew.
But you still ate it.
Yeah, but with tears. With tears.
My kids and I also tried it.
What do you think?
Yummy.
The owner, Gerard Lowe, says it's actually not so crazy when you think about the ingredients of scallion noodle gelato. It's basically sweet and savory, with sweetness from sugar and umami from soy sauce. But he says you need to take a few licks to let it grow on you.
First taste, not weird. And then second taste, interesting, not too bad. And the third time they try it, it's magical. Yeah, then they start to love it.
Lo and Lu Xiaoxun, the owner of Bonus Gelato, say China's ice cream market is just getting going, like how coffee was here 30 years ago. If that's the case, then, well, we're in for a treat. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
Think space race, and maybe two things will come to mind. There's the Cold War rivalry between the U.S. and the USSR. There's also today and the cadre of super billionaires who have launched themselves into space, like Amazon's Jeff Bezos earlier this week. There's another place that is also focused on Earth's orbit and beyond that isn't getting that much attention, Africa. Our next guest is at the cutting edge of that scene. Temidayo Oni-Osun is the managing director of Space in Africa, a space consulting firm in Lagos, Nigeria. Temidayo, a number of African countries have launched satellites into space in recent years. Just give us a sense of where these programs are.
Currently, 13 African countries have been able to put a satellite into space. These countries include Algeria, Angola, Egypt, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mauritius, Morocco, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Sudan, and Tunisia. And altogether, these countries have launched 41 satellites. Then we have three other satellites that were multilateral projects, where multiple countries came together to put these into space.
And the satellites mostly used for communications, I guess?
Yes, it's the combination of Earth observation and communication services.
So that is a very active scene. Do any countries have manned spaceflight programs yet, or even in development?
Currently, we only have Nigeria and Egypt that have announced plans to run a human spaceflight program. So Nigeria is hoping to go to the moon in the near future, around 2030. Egypt also announced plan to actually have an astronaut into space a couple of years ago. And presently, they are in the process of selecting an astronaut candidate that they would send to the International Space Station.
So your consultancy, Temidayo, Space in Africa, estimates that a number of African governments have ramped up space program investments in the last year alone. So how much has this industry grown and what is driving the growth?
That's an interesting question. So Africa's space budget, it has actually grown over 100% in the last 3-4 years. More countries are trying to develop space program. There's more satellite program coming out of the continent. And we're also seeing a rise in the number of private companies that are operating in this space. So these are companies that are developing satellite component, as well as companies that are capitalizing on these space technologies to address different socioeconomic problems across the continent.
So one big criticism of the Jeff Bezos space launch this week and the Richard Branson one not so long ago, for example, is why these massive expenses in the billions of dollars when there are so many problems to address here on Earth. So how are these countries, how are they justifying space exploration?
So that's the difference. America's space program is more of space exploration. In Africa, it's more of space application. So African space program is not really about, let's go to the moon or to the Mars and things like that. It's really about how can we capitalize on space as a technology to address our developmental problem. So whether it's problems in security, whether it is disaster monitoring, whether it's in improving agricultural yield, or in building sustainable cities and communities. Take, for example, more than half of Africa is unconnected. More than half of Africa do not have access to internet connectivity. This is a problem that can be addressed with communication satellite. And this is what some of these countries are trying to do. So you go to Egypt, you go to Nigeria, you go to Algeria. These countries are now capitalizing on their communication satellite to provide connectivity to those rural areas. And, you know, this has effect in the area of telemedicine as well as remote education. I mean, since COVID broke out, you know, it's been about, oh, how can we access education remotely? These countries are now capitalizing on these technologies to do this.
So those benefits you're talking about, Temidayo, I mean, are African governments telling that to their people when they say, we're launching a rocket and these are the benefits?
Definitely. I mean, because in some of these countries, before you can even get the government to, you know, sign off some of these budgets, you need to be able to prove that this is actually worth it. Because if you have a country where, you know, more than half of the population, you know, are below the poverty line, then how do you want to justify sending someone to space? That doesn't make sense. So it's about, you know, convincing the government to say, oh, we have a problem of security. We can use surveillance satellite to actually address it. So let's invest in this. So this is what African countries are doing.
I mean, that's a very practical approach after a couple of weeks of space joyrides. I'm curious, though, did you ever have a dream of being an astronaut, or was your own personal goal always to have space in service of people on Earth?
I think personally, I'm more interested in the application of it, in this, you know, space services, you know, addressing problems with this technology. But, you know, doesn't mean that if I get a chance to go to space in the future that I won't take.
Mm-hmm. Temidayo Oniosun, the managing director of Space in Africa, a space consulting firm based in Lagos, Nigeria. Good to meet you. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is the official start of the long-awaited, long-debated Olympic Games in Tokyo. For first-time Olympians, the Games will be a whirlwind, made even more overwhelming by the restrictions and risk of COVID. For athletes for whom this is not their first rodeo, there's experience to lean on. That's especially true for Hungary's Ida Mohamed. At 45 years old, this is her seventh Olympic Games. Mohamed spoke with me yesterday from Tokyo, and I asked the Olympic veteran what the last year was like for her.
For myself, the whole year, it was just really difficult, as for everybody. Even myself, I went through the COVID, and I can say that the recovery was very long. For 2 months, completely we stopped. I'm saying we because a couple of my teammates was infected as well. And a couple of months, we stopped completely. And for myself, it took like 4 or 5 months at least to get back and recover.
How hard was that to come out of having had COVID and start training again?
It was very hard because I could feel like my pulse just raised, just sitting at home and barely doing anything. I could feel my heartbeat nonstop, and I had some signs that was unusual. And kind of we were just all scared what's happening, you know, if you do a little bit more training or push it harder. So myself, I came back very slowly and very carefully, of course, because I can see as I'm an experienced athlete as well, it was even more important. You know, a younger body can regenerate faster, but I was always more careful.
Well, you are now in Tokyo, just recently arrived, still in a hotel, not yet at the Olympic Village, though. What's the protocol been like so far, and what are you being told is going to happen once you get to the Olympic Village?
So right now we're staying 5-6 days in a hotel separately. And we are allowed only go to the training core. So you can imagine we spend as much time as possible in the training core. So even if we don't have to, we just go back and go for a game or just do some extra because it's in a bigger place. But most of the time we're staying just in the hotel in our room, or if we just want to have some company, just go on the corridor. And that's all. We cannot leave the level of the hotel. And tomorrow we are going to move to the village. We have to keep similar protocols, as even in the hotel, every day we are tested.
So as I said, Ida, this will be your seventh time competing in the Olympics. What do these games mean for you specifically?
Yes, this is the seventh. And I can see in Hungary, this is a record breaker. So I'm very proud. And, you know, it's always, if they wrote your name in the record book, it's always a great thing. I know my friends and family are very proud of me and happy. It means a lot to me. It's a good feeling, great feeling.
After so many trips to the Olympics, even one like this in Tokyo that is so unusual, has it ever started to feel routine?
It never feels routine. Even in my last tournament, I was the same excited as my first tournament, and I can say the same on the Olympic Games. Only one thing changed, it's that I'm more experienced. This is number one. And the second, that I'm training harder than ever, because I can say with my age, I have to keep up with the younger ones. So I even put more hours than I would put before.
Well, you make a good point. You've been doing this for a while. First time competing in the Olympics was in 1996 in Atlanta. Feels like a lifetime ago. What do you remember from those first Olympic Games that you attended?
I remember I was one of the youngest team member. Everything was so big and so bright. I remember the audience, so many people. And in fencing, usually you don't get as many visitors or spectators. I remember in the Olympic Games, it was fully packed. And that was a great thing to compete under those circumstances. Contra now in Tokyo, that will be very empty.
How do you feel about that?
I just have to keep the crowd there. I have to think that, you know, there will be people sitting around and cheering for me. But I think it makes a big difference feeling-wise. And it always helps, you know, when someone is cheering for you and you can hear the people screaming and noise. And that's always a great thing.
Yeah, it's that energy that you get. I'm curious how you got into fencing in the first place, Ida. How old were you? What drew you to the sport?
I was 9 years old in the elementary school. And that time, my coach from my old club came to school and looking for kids, you know, selecting. I remember very clearly I had to make some exercise, but that time I was a really shy little girl. And I just, you know, I was so excited that I couldn't make properly the exercise. But even that time, I was fast and I was good in the gymnastic lesson. And my school teacher advised me to go and start with the others. My coach always, Antal Shorty, who's been my coach since 35 years.
Right. He's been with you the whole time. What has he meant to you?
Well, he's more than a coach, for sure. He was kind of like a father, I always say. He was always checking on, not only, in sport. He would tell me what to do, what not to do. But he was always paying attention to my school. So I remember those days when he would ask everybody, okay, bring your notes, from school. He would have some words if you didn't have the right notes. So he would tell, okay, now you have to study harder. There's no excuse. But he was always, like a father. If I had any problem, even up to nowadays, I could tell him and I could discuss with him. And he was always a very strict man and loud. But if I had any problem, I could always go to him and share. And I remember one training that my girlfriends or my fencing mates, somebody would cry on his shoulder because of love problems. Somebody would cry because of the school problems. I was crying from some other problems. And I think that's what made him really unique.
So 7th Olympic Games for you, first Hungarian to do this ever. How do you want to be remembered?
I just hope that people will remember me as an example for hard work. Not by the numbers, but somebody that enjoyed fencing. And many times I heard that people loved my fencing style and my techniques. Just remembered as a big fighter.
Ida Mohamed is an Olympic fencer representing Hungary this year in Tokyo for her 7th. Yep, that is right. Her 7th Olympic Games. Ida, thank you very much. Good luck to you.
Thank you, too. And for everybody, I wish have a nice day.
The opening ceremonies are tomorrow, despite COVID, despite additional minor scandals. In Japan, feelings about the Olympics are complicated, to say the least.
It's really easy to get this impression that, like, Japan messed up, and I would never want people to see Japan that way.
Join us for that story tomorrow here on The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.